Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Maria Hadzu, CEO of LifeBit, coming to us from London. How's your day going, Maria?
Hello, Nathan. It's going really great.
Awesome. So Maria is out in the field right now, and you're in what neighborhood? You said Angel Street or Angel Area?
Angel Area. The offices of LifeBit are just basically next to the Angel Station. So I was on my way to another meeting as usual.
I love it. This is like real life startup life. Like, let's pack in a podcast while we're walking from one meeting to another. That's good. All right. Exactly. Tell us about LifeBit. What do you guys do?
So LifeBit is on the mission of basically building a full-blown cognitive system, so a software technology that will enable our basically clients, pharmaceutical industries, biotechnology companies, research and government organizations to streamline their analysis of genetic data and basically reach insights much faster and better. So that's what LifeBit's all about.
So your customers would be governments or pharma labs, or who would be the customer in this?
We have a big range of customers. So as we like to say, everyone that analyzes or need to analyze genetic data for whatever purposes that might be, ranging from basically research, clinical application, drug discovery reason, research and development again within pharmaceuticals, or even for wellness and lifestyle recommendations, or even for basically building better products that are for nutrition, wellness and lifestyle, and even cosmetics, then pretty much, the LifeBit technology is here to help them do a much better job at that, and also enable a big portion of these clients and individuals that basically right now they would like to be able to analyze and understand genetic data, but they don't necessarily know how, or they have the technology in place that will enable them to do that in a time frame that would actually make sense.
Okay, interesting. And are you guys in the market now, or is this still in development phase?
No, we are in the market as of like a month and a half ago. We just launched our first product into the market. It's called Deployed. It's more of the I would say bioinformatics engineers. So basically the more the data scientists that analyze the data. So the tool is more for them. Rather they're more, I would say more end customers or more geneticists or more anyhow people that do not have that much data analytics and computational skills yet. And it's a beta version. We are now at the stage where we are like piloting the platform with different companies and research organizations and governmental as well.
Very interesting. Okay. And where did you come up with this idea? What were you doing before starting LifeBit?
So both myself and my co-founder, Pablo, we're computer scientists by training. Then we did a master's in bioinformatics and we just worked also for Pablo was working for different startups, for a startup, and then as a consultant, I was working as a bioinformatics research engineer in some of the biggest research institutes. And then eventually we decided that we will both start working as researchers at the Center for Genomic Regulation, so this big international genomics research institute in Barcelona, and we'll also do a PhD there. And then we met during that period because we were working basically in the same group. And a lot of the things that we did anyhow during our time there as PhDs, but also as researchers, had quite a lot of success with not just the scientific community, but also all the outside the scientific community, basically with different companies and different organizations. And because of that, we got the chance to interact with really many people, and actually within research and academia, but also within industry. And very soon we actually saw a huge need of, and that need being basically that everyone was trying to build custom software and hardware to somehow like be able to handle and basically convert genetic data to actionable insights, right? So be able to analyze them and understand what they mean, and then get out of that actionable insight that will inform them about how to develop better drugs, better therapies, better diagnostics, better products, I was saying before, give better wellness recommendations to people. So we just saw that big gap. And then we're like, most probably we can do something about it. I mean, a lot of the work that we did already while we were still researchers already sort of like solved part of that problem for a big bunch of people. So then we were like, well, all we have to do now is build the rest of the technology stack to make it completely automated.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Okay, I was just reading, I think, somewhere recently about how they're close to cracking the genome for wheat, which is a surprisingly like complex code. And I guess that, you know, is pretty exciting because then you can, you know, build or modify wheat to withstand, you know, changing environments and climate change and stuff like that. Is that kind of in the right vein? I mean, is that like an example of what your customers could be doing?
Yes, it's so funny that you mentioned that, because actually my co-founder was in the project that actually they did the first sort of like reference genome for the wheat. So basically a lot of most probably his work is helping towards cracking the rest of the stuff needed for that.
Very interesting. Yeah, really amazing. Cool. Okay, really, really good stuff. This is like pretty much mostly over my head, but I'm fascinated by it anyway. Let's see. So talk about getting this company off the ground. Why did you start it in London? It sounds like you, are you both from Spain originally?
My co-founder is Spanish, from Barcelona, but I am Greek. And by now I think I'm like very much European. I've lived in all over the place, like Sweden and Germany for a while, and London for a while, and then Barcelona for the past 5 years. And yeah.
Okay. So what led you to England as your home for starting LifeBit?
So what led us here? So within Europe, I would say UK is the one country leading, I would say, the genomics and personalized medicine revolution. And a lot of our clients are here. A lot of the most exciting projects are here. A lot of the talent and the big research basically projects are within the Golden Triangle, being London, Cambridge, and Oxford. So that was one of the main reasons. The other reason was that LifeBit is actually my second startup. My first startup is called Innovation Forum. And I did we co-founded with a couple of other people, and that's more of a non-for-profit organization. So sort of like a LinkedIn for like entrepreneurial scientists, if you want, bringing together entrepreneurial scientists wanting to create startups. Mm. And because of that, I mean, we managed to grow Innovation Forum now. It's running in over 3 continents. We have over 200 people, most of them, of course, volunteers. But I got quite a lot of experience, and a lot of my support network, because the headquarters of Innovation Forum are in Cambridge, we're actually in UK, so I knew a lot of people here. And I think that was the second main reason. And the third is because we got accepted to Techstars London, who were our first investors, and who, as I say, transformed. When we entered Techstars, I believe our company was still a project. Well, there was no company, there was a nice project. And when we exited Techstars, we had the proper startup, and they were our first investor. They were here in London, and then the follow-up investors was the follow-up investment. So our seed investment was from UK VCs, London VCs, basically. So then, yeah, we had all of the reasons in the world to actually stay in London.
Yeah, that makes sense. Talk about Techstars a little bit. So was that one of these vertical tracks that I see Techstars doing a lot of, or was it their kind of general program?
No, it was a general program. They really liked it because the first time I ever pitched the company was at the Women Who Tech Startup Challenge 2017. And I was very lucky because one of the judges was Max Kelly, the former MD, managing director of Techstars London. And it was so funny because when I pitched there, he really, really loved my pitch. Again, I didn't have anything, well, apart from the prior, whatever traction we had as a researcher and the experience, but we didn't have yet anything for the company apart from a very great vision about how we wanted to do things. And he really liked it because we were pitching not yet another biotech company, if that makes sense, but more of like a true technology company that was trying to build a true infrastructure and true technology applied in the biomedical world, basically. So then he said, like, you are a great fit for Techstars. And I also thought the same because, as I said, I was looking to build a deep tech company, but a true technology company. Therefore, it was like a perfect match. And
yeah,
we were actually the first genomics company of Techstars. We still are, I think, or now we have a couple of more. So it was quite interesting as well for them.
I bet. But you completed that in 2017, and then you raised, I guess, your seed round more recently. Yeah. So did you start raising money right out of Techstars, or did you need to wait for a while?
No, I actually started raising money just after Techstars, and it took me not that much. We announced the round quite late, just because we wanted to be stealth for a while.
Okay.
Until we have a product and for other reasons. But actually, I just closed my round just after 2 months of fundraising, my seed round.
Okay,
and
great.
We raised over $3 million. I mean, we raised about 2.25 million in pounds, basically. So there is a TechCrunch press release for that. So it's all now public information.
Yeah, cool. So talk about that. So did you use, you know, Techstars Demo Day as the catalyst to kick off real fundraising? Yeah. And, you know, what's it like raising in the UK? I haven't actually had anyone else from the UK on this show yet, so I'd love to hear.
That's great. I think UK is a great place to fundraise. It depends, of course, what sector you are in and what is exactly that you are pitching. I think, but there is a lot of money, especially in London. There's a really, really high caliber investors. For me, I would say, it was quite exhausting, my fundraising, I guess, like every fundraising round is, but it was a pleasure to actually be meeting all of those investors. So I would say the experience was overall really, really good. And to be honest, we had quite a lot of traction and interest from both US investors, but also other European investors. And we had also term sheets on the table that weren't from UK investors. And I personally decided that I wanted to go with basically Pentec and Connect, who are two big London VCs, because I wanted to actually work with close to my investors. And then I decided to leave the other investors for consideration for the Series A.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about, you know, how you actually did it. Did you just identify all the big data and or genomics investors in the UK and, you know, work through Techstars to reach out to them, or really give us a little bit of like the tactical?
Mm-hmm. So basically during Techstars, we met a lot of people, but then did I spend some extra effort to identify the right ones for us? Not at all. I think for me, I run, so basically I just, literally I followed, I followed the playbook of Texas on how to fundraise, and it was extremely successful. So I ran fundraising basically within what I call the three phases of fundraising. So phase one was basically just raise awareness and just meet as many people as you can, because even if you, of course, you know pretty much, you can try to filter investors and like, oh, these I will talk, these I won't talk. But eventually it's more important to actually go and meet them, and then you get a better feeling. So that's what I did. And I had over 170 investor meetings in 2 months, which is crazy if you think about it.
170?
Yes. Over 170 investor meetings in 2 months.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. So the first stage was just like, anyone that wanted to meet with me, I will just accept the meeting. It didn't matter to me if they had the money I wanted or the expertise I wanted. I would just would talk to anyone. And I would basically use each one of my meetings to refine my message, to understand different investors had different sort of like levels of like understanding of the genomics market. And It was totally fine, because that was equally helpful for me, because you know I had to pitch at different levels, and it was, if anything, was really 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 beneficial. And the other thing that I think investors also appreciated is that on all of those meetings I used an approach of like not going into the meeting saying like, oh, like what can I get out of this, but more of like I'm here to tell you what I'm doing, and I'm here to really learn what you are trying to do, what you are trying to get out of, like, you know, potentially investing at LifeBit. And then basically I run those meetings more of as a chat, and as like, if you want me to educate you, I'm more than happy to educate you, you know. So a lot of the discussion weren't even about the company, were about like, how do you think about that, what about this, like explain me that, then I will be like more than happy to. And via versa was like, just tell me about the companies in your portfolio. Have you invested in any big data company, any infrastructure company, in any biotech company, in those that you have invested? How did that go? How do you feel about that? You know, what were the, you know, the obstacles these companies had to face? And that was extremely beneficial for me. Yeah. Then I ran this phase for a while, and then phase two was more of like...
Hey, real quick, on I want to get to phase two, but on the phase one, were you telling these folks in the raise awareness phase, were you telling them we are fundraising or we're going to be fundraising? Was it kind of like a warm-up chat, or was it we're raising money?
No, we're raising money. That was after the demo day. And even before the demo day, of course, I was meeting with whoever I wanted to meet. But it was my clear message that I'm not fundraising. I'm just meeting you to just catch up, to get to know you. And when the demo day happened, I was like, we're fundraising. And then I was kept meeting everyone again and again. I was saying like, and I would always go super prepared with my pitch deck and all of the business model and everything, right? But I would still run it as like, we're fundraising. We're here to just, and then I would run a process through that.
Okay. 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 Sorry to interrupt you. Now phase two, what was that phase?
Phase two is basically understand, after you have met with everyone, understand which are the investors that are more likely actually to be a match, because I think it's a match, right? So it's not just if they can invest or if they would invest or if they are appropriate about investing, but it's also about like, how was the chemistry? Do you see, you know, like, you know, getting into this marriage with the particular, you know, investment firm, right? And then the second phase was all about like going to the next phase of meetings with the investors that were ready to put term sheets on the table. And the second phase was all about like drilling down with those investors and telling them, okay, you like us, we like you. What needs to happen for you to put a term sheet forward on the table, right? And then they will give me everything that they needed. And then we'll run that process basically, and we'll have as many meetings as that needed. And then third, phase three, when we had...
And Maria, sorry to interrupt one more time. And how many, so from the 170 in the phase one, how many do you think you met with in phase two? How short was the list? Yeah.
I think the 170 was a total for all of my round, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I had about like 100 initial meetings, and then all of the follow-ups were about like, I don't know, like 50 meetings in total with the, I don't know, with the several investors. I have all of those numbers. I just don't have them in front of me.
Sure. No problem.
But that was sort of like the breakdown with the investors that were seriously considering of putting a term sheet forward, right?
Yeah.
And then we just only continued on the phase three with the investors that had put a term sheet passed forward, basically.
Sure. Great. Okay. So then you're in phase three. You've got, you know, half a dozen term sheets or five or six or?
I had a couple of term sheets that I would rather not say because then people would say, oh, who was it? And I would rather not.
That's fine. That's fine.
If that's okay. But we had several term sheets on the table. And then we decided to just move on. So when we had the couple of term sheets that we had on the table, we still, if we kept have going, we would have more. But then we decided to stop when we had the term sheet that we really liked. And then eventually we couldn't actually decide between Fintech and Connect. And then because they were bringing very complementary things on the table, Connect specializes on product and they have invested in some really incredible companies like CityMapper and Typeform and many others. And then Fintech, on the other hand, has a really great track record on basically biotech companies and true innovation. And they have already like IPO companies that have IPO'd on their portfolio and so on and so forth. So basically we went back to them and said like, how do you feel about doing a co-lead? And they said like, we would love that. And we're like, cool, because then it means that we don't need to choose. And then basically we just moved on with them. And by phase three, and for me, the phase three was all about closing the investment agreement and getting the money into the bank. And I know that a lot of people underestimate the phase three, where it is like, oh, we had the term sheet, we have like agreed that yeah, we'll now get the investment agreement, but a lot of things can go wrong on that, and a lot of things can delay so much that it basically can kill your company. So I was running that process very, very like how can I say, a very with a great persistence and follow through.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit. And you don't need to say like what things could have gone wrong for you specifically, but what were some of the potential trouble areas or pitfalls that, you know, startups need to watch out for in that closing phase? Because I don't think the closing is actually talked about enough. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I'm happy to also discuss about what we had the problem. So
yeah.
When we got the joint term sheet from both our VCs, was, as my chairman called it, a term sheet made in heaven for entrepreneurs. So I was like, that's really great. And my chairman is like 75 and he has like been a CEO of like of basically multi-billion companies and has invested in companies and so forth. So basically he has seen everything. So him saying that was like, oh my God, that's really great. And it was making me very happy because I knew I had found the right type of investors that totally get what we're doing, totally understand the challenges moving forward. But then when we came to the lawyers, and then the lawyers took that term sheet and then drafted sort of like an investment agreement, then the law firm we were dealing with from the investor side decided that they actually wanted to put a totally different investment agreement that was basically just renegotiating everything that wasn't on the term sheet, basically, and to the worst benefit of us, basically, mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
And that was quite sad to see, especially because the law firm is quite a famous law mm-hmm. firm here in London, and a lot of investors are using them. For me, I have actually banned them. I'm literally telling to my next investors, like, if you are using them, then just I'm not accepting any deal from you. Like, you can stop talking. And that is, for example, one of the most typical stuff. I think in general, lawyers can screw up a lot of things, even if you have negotiated things with your investors. And for us, it came to a point where we had to actually, at some point, it became like a very frustration point where we where basically my investors were like, Maria, how about we actually just removing the lawyers from the picture and we just start talking with each other and we agree on everything and we'll just tell them to draft it and that's it. And I'm like, how about we do that?
Yeah.
Were you in a
no shop clause, like where you could not, you know, pursue other term sheets? You were kind of, locked up in this term sheet at this point. So are you kind of, you know what I'm asking?
No, I wasn't locked up. And to be honest, I seriously thought about it because I had investors calling me at the same time where they were telling me just, you know, like, go out of this round. Now we can give you more money, better this, better that, or kick that investor and we can come in and so on and so forth. So, and it's a true temptation, especially when, you know, things are not that ideal because, and not because my investors were doing something bad but because, you know, the lawyers had sort of like screwed up things. And I'm happy I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. And there is a real danger, right? Because when you are a first time sort of like entrepreneur, for me, I'm a second time sort of, but I've never fundraised. So this was my first experience with that. And there was a true danger. So if I didn't have really great people basically mentoring me and advising me, where they were like, you don't know. And I didn't know at that point, like, I knew my investors were like super cool and I already really liked them, but I never had worked with them, right? Yeah. So I'm happy, you know, like I didn't walk out of the deal and I just basically made it happen.
Awesome. Great. Any other, you know, either tips on that closing period? How long did that take? Like, what was the closing timeline?
Really, really fast. But again, I'm a very crazy person. So I know I'm complaining a lot, but it actually to close the whole thing with the money being in the bank was maybe about a month.
Yeah, that's really fast. What do you think was so? I mean, this is like, you know, one of these like pretty almost perfect stories where you hear things go so fast and
yes,
a few hiccups, but what do you think was the strength of your pitch? Like why were you able to get it done so quickly? Was it just big data and genomics are hot, sexy spaces, or the Techstars cachet? What do you think was underlying this?
I think it was the first phase of the awareness phase. If you ask me, so don't get me wrong. Definitely. What matters always the most is what is your story and basically what is the founder's traction, right? Are the founders relevant to what they are pitching, right? Do they know what they are doing, right? Is the market really big? Is there huge potential, right, for growth? All of those things matter. They are the first things that everyone will check, right? But once those things are sort of like, okay, then it's all about, I think for me, the first phase that a lot of people again underestimate, right? Where they think that in the first phase, all they need to do is like look down to the 10 investors that they want and then just go and try to chase them desperately. And I so did not do that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just speaking to everyone. And because I did that, just investors started liking me. And then they started saying like, literally, I never actually mailed not a single investor to actually ask for a meeting. To all of the investors that I had, and there was really many investors, I was introduced by other investors, basically, where they're like, I'm not investing in them because I don't know, like their seed round is too big or we are not investing in that, but we really like them and I think you should totally like talk to them. And that is how I got all of my meetings. And just because of that, then, you know, investors is a small group, right? So investors normally talk with each other. And although people tend to think that, oh, investors are competitive to each other, they really aren't, right? They normally consult each other and they normally ask each other for diligence and expertise, right? And because at that point, I had pretty much talked to every investor almost in London and Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Not so much in Cambridge, but definitely in London. So everyone knew about me. And I think that really, really speeded up the time because then you know, like investors could very fast reference about us, and we at the same time had the credibility of Techstars. So yeah, and I think that was number one, I would say. In terms of number two, a lot of founders, what they do, their mistake is like they feel that fundraising is sort of like I don't know, like a job. It's not a job. It's literally a sprint. It's something that it's a way of living. You need to like basically say that for the next 3 months, 4 months, whatever it takes, I'm not doing anything else in my life, right? It's not my job. It's literally my life. For me, it was my life. Like I was waking up in the morning and I had like meetings and I was going from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting. And in the evenings, I was preparing everything. I was refining my pitch. I was refining my messaging. I was preparing the extra documents, right? And then you keep going, basically. That was maybe my second tip to everyone. This is like, don't think this as a thing to do or as a job to do. Think this as a way of living, and there's nothing you are doing. And then the third thing that I could say is like, get a back office space person, meaning that I had my COO, that she was always there. And basically I was telling her, we need to mail this investor this and that, or I just exited from the meeting, this investor needs this and that. And then, oh, we need to get those documents going. Oh, we need to correct those errors on the business model. Oh, we need to refine these numbers. Oh, we need to get more information on that company that this investor, or we need to check those investors, right? And basically, while I was running onto meetings, she was doing all of the job for me. And then while I was in the Ubers, walking on the buses, even on the subway, like she were on the underground, like she would have mailed me stuff and will catch up about all of the information that I needed. So then I would be super prepared for my next meeting.
Wow. Sounds like, I hope she's still with you, or did she get through the fundraising and just like, I'm done?
No, she is. So basically, yeah, it was a way of living for both of us. And, and literally like we would like, we would catch up with her. Like I would reach home, and at some time I would even have meetings until like 8-9 o'clock because I was speaking with US investors with different time zones, right? And we would catch up with her until like 11-12-1 o'clock, and we'll still work on documents because that was the time frame when we had to work, right? But yeah. But it depends, right? So again, like you said before that, oh, you know, this sounds like these stories that sound so perfect and everything moves so fast and you just have some hiccups, and trust me, for those stories to happen, there is so much work that has to happen behind the scenes.
Yep.
That we had to do.
It's the duck metaphor, right? The duck is calmly gliding across the water, but underneath it's paddling furiously, right?
Yeah. Yes. Sort of, yes. Yes, it was the same thing.
This is great. I mean, and then I guess just going forward, are you already thinking about your next round? Will you be thinking about going to the US for the next round? Or, you know, how are you thinking about, is this a business that's going to take a lot of money? How are you thinking about fundraising?
Yes. Yes, this is a business that will take a lot of money. Unfortunately, I wish I could say like, no. A joke that I would always do with my investors when they were asking me, okay, so what's your marketing style or what do you do? I was like, we do all of the buzzwords apart from blockchain, but we need money for that. So literally, because we do big data, we do genomics, we do AI, we do high performance computing, cloud computing. We do all of that thing, and what we need to be building. So basically, literally, what the big mission of Life, we put very, very simply, is like right now, the process of sort of like making sense of your genetic data, it's sort of like sorry, there is a siren.
It's okay.
It's sort of like a two-step process, right? The first is all about the biochemical process of getting a sample and extracting the DNA and just reading that DNA, right? And that right now, it's super automated, right? And it costs less than it actually costs you to buy an iPhone, which is insane if you think about it. It takes less than half a day to done. And then you have your DNA read, all of it, right? But now the problem with that is like you cannot do absolutely anything because that DNA is just like fragments of DNA duplicated and just like random letters, like a matrix sort of like screen if you were to output it, right? So then the second part of the process starts where you actually need to analyze all of this DNA and basically get insights, right? And that process is not automated at all. It takes a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of pain to actually get anything meaningful out of that, right? Which is why, you know, genetic data are not being used for wide clinical application. We're not, you know, we're not having personalized medicine. We're not having everything that we could actually, that genetic data could actually enable, right? And all LifeBit is trying to do at the end of the day is build this technology that will make that process of going from raw data that come from the sequencing machines to the insights and the questions you want to answer fully automatically, right? And with zero pain points and, you know, super fast. And to do that, you need a lot of money and you need really bright people to build insane technology. And that's why we need money. So going into our Series A round, I think for us Series A round will come after a year or so. It will depend, of course, on the growth of the company as well. We are already talking with really big Series A investors, which we were anyhow in contact during our seed round. But we will need money and most probably we'll go to get that money in the US.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'd have to open an office in the US or do you think you could raise from London in US investors?
To be honest, I think we'll need to have a presence in US. But for us, it also makes sense because half of the genetics market is in the US and it's actually the part of it that actually is the fastest growing. So anyhow, we will make an office there as, you know, as basically the growth phase of the company, which anyhow will have to be in the US and work more with the US market and with more of the clinical side of the US market, which right now we're not so much targeting. I mean, we're still, even now we're actually working with some clinics and stuff, but it's more of the clinics that do have more research parts of it, and they are now experimenting with genetics rather than, you know, like hospitals and like, you know, completely diagnosis to customers, to end basically, to patients.
Do you feel like your UK investors have good relationships with American investors, or are they kind of their own independent Brexit ecosystem? What do you think?
I think I need to run a full phase one, investment phase to actually get, understand that a little bit better, because I don't have a full picture right now, but, from my limited experience so far, I would say they have quite good relationship, right? Our VCs know a lot of VCs in US. They work together. They back really good companies. At the end of the day, you know, like investors like working together when it is to go for something big that has a risk component to it. They actually, you know, it's good for them because they de-risk investments, right? And there is no American investor that would say, oh, you know, we wouldn't invest in this company or, you know, like just because they are in UK or because they are in Europe or because they have UK investors or anything like that. I think it's on the contrary. They will just back up anything that's really good.
Yeah. Okay. Last question. Anything we haven't covered or any tips you would give your younger self going through or starting the fundraising process all over again? Or did you do it just right because you did it pretty successfully and quickly?
I think I did it just right. Maybe my maybe my only advice to myself, if I was to go back in time, was like not to stress that much and understand that it is a process, that it takes the time it will take eventually. Like, yes, you can cut corners and you can hack different stuff, but eventually it is a process. And I think that would be my general advice to everyone. It's sort of like they need to just understand that, you know, they need to buckle up and like go for it. It's a process, you know, it will take the time it will take. It will has the frustration that it will have. And it's a process that requires a lot of like people management above all, because a lot of people say like, oh, it's about the startups and the technology and the mission and the vision. Yes, it is definitely about that. But, and then a lot of people say, oh, it's about the money and, you know, convincing that there is revenue and opportunity. It's definitely also about that. But what it's more and above all, it's about people relationship. Like, you need to convince, like, especially when you are, we raise that amount of money basically as a pre-revenue company and totally pre-product company. Mm-hmm. We literally almost had nothing apart from like a lousy MVP that was barely working, right? So at the end of the day, is like you are trying to build a relationship that, you know, you're trying to literally ask people to trust you and to take a huge bet on you. Like literally when I was presenting all of my vision and all of my all of the huge potential and all of like, you know, how, you know, we can become the next Google and Apple of the, all of the genomics revolution and of the biotech revolution. And then investors would actually, of course, because the investors I would interact with were like very high caliber. They would eventually ask me like, Maria, we buy all of that, but tell me why you would be that one company and not someone else. And I'm like, right. And my answer to that would be literally would be like, if I am honest, I don't know if I'm going to be that company, but if I was to bet, make a bet right now, and if I was you, I would. We are your best bet. So, so it's your. And it's true. It's literally true. Like I was saying that, and was being totally honest with them, right? Which is yet another big thing. Like, be as honest as possible. Investors can totally see through you, right? And that's what I'm trying to tell them. Like, I'm not gonna bullshit you. Like, that I can tell you that we will do the best that we can. We have a really solid plan. We know where we're coming from and we definitely know where we're going. No one knows the future. Like this is an emerging market. Like there's a lot of things that could go wrong that no one could anticipate, even if you're God himself, right? But literally, if you are to make a bet, we're your best bet, which then make it well, then do I really like you, right? Do I really want to make this bet with you, right? And there is where, you know, the more personal component comes to place. And that is what I would definitely, if I was to advise founders, was like, do not underestimate that. And do not underestimate that. And the end of the day is a people's game. It's really building those relationships, regardless if people are going to invest in you or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Really cool. All right, Maria, this is great. If people want to learn more, it's just lifebit.ai. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Easier than my name, right?
Say your last name one more time. I butchered it, I know.
Had to.
Okay, great. Maybe I'll copy and paste that at the beginning, you know, kind of like the overdub.
That's totally fine, no worries.
This is awesome. Anything you want to kind of plug or mention to listeners, open job recs, anything special?
I guess maybe I can have an ask.
Sure, yeah.
My ask, I always have an ask for people. My ask would be like, if people like listening to this podcast, they really love our vision and they're looking for jobs or they're looking to interact or they're buying from a vision and looking for a cool platform to use for their company, then definitely we're here to actually help you with that. And, you know, like we run now this pilot program and this partnership program, and we're really happy to talk to these people. So that would be my ask number one. And then my ask number two, which is a selfish ask, is like, if anyone needs help and needs more advice, I'm here for them. Just mail me. It's really easy, Maria at life Dotnet.ai. I hope I'm not getting like 1,000 mails after saying this. But I'm happy to help founders, and especially if they're first founders. So please mail me if you need anything.
Well, that's great. That's really wonderful. All right. Thank you so much. This is really fun. Lots of good stuff in here. And good luck. It sounds like pretty exciting stuff. I'll definitely follow you guys, and we'll catch you after your next round. How about that?
Yes. That sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Maria.
Okay. Bye. Thank you so much, Nathan. Bye-bye.